Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. At least 6,000 New Hampshire adults have legal guardians. And as the population ages, that number will likely go up as more people are deemed unable to provide for their own needs. The courts are heavily involved in guardianship decisions, requiring all kinds of proof and paperwork and legal documents. The red tape exists to protect the person in question, but it does mean becoming a guardian can be expensive. It can also be emotionally taxing, especially if there's disagreement about whether someone really needs a guardian, and if so, who that person should be. Today in The Exchange, adult guardians. What questions or personal experiences do you have with this? Let us know. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have three guests for the hour. Scott McGuffin is here, attorney at McGuffin Law, where he specializes in guardianship. He's also a guardian for an adult and is on the board of the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys. And Scott, it's good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Glad to be here.
Also with us, Doug McNutt. He works on advocacy with AARP. And Doug, welcome back. Good to see you too.
Thank you.
And also with us, Suzanne Chisholm, founding attorney with Lawson Pearson and Chisholm. She's a probate and estate planning lawyer, and she also serves as an adult guardian. And Suzanne, it's good to meet you. Thank you also for being here.
Nice to be here.
Well, Suzanne, what are some of the different situations in which people come to this place of becoming guardians? What's typical?
Well, the cases that I've been seeing lately for the financial guardians, you have to keep in mind there's two separate sets of guardianships. There's over the person, which is to make medical decisions and make decisions about placement, versus financial decisions where someone can't pay their bills or manage their assets anymore. So what I've been seeing a lot in my practice with the financial guardianships are elders who are being taken advantage of in scam situations where, you know, it's the, I hate to say the Nigerian prince because that's the classic, but, you know, you've won the lottery in Spain, you know, send us your bank account information and things like that. And so we've been doing a lot in our office with, you know, children coming forward because the parents have gotten involved in some sort of scam and they don't seem to understand or want to understand that it is a scam and that they're going to lose their money. I mean, this is, It's I've had clients literally lose millions of dollars through these scams.
Wow. People still fall for that. I'm hurting in Nigeria or wherever, because you're right, a lot of the emails do seem to come from there. They still fall for that.
Yes. Yes. And there's been Scott and I went to a seminar last fall on financial exploitation of the elderly, and the Brandon Garrod with the Attorney General's office has been assigned to deal with a lot of these cases where there's elder abuse and they were talking about the different scams. I mean, the scams change all the time. You know, it's people will call and say, I'm the grandson and I've been arrested and, you know, can you send me, you know, grandma, can you send me money and things like that. So
financial guardianship is what you're seeing these days.
Right. I mean, we always see the medical guardianships, you know, someone's had a stroke, they're in the hospital, they don't have a financial or a healthcare power of attorney. Those are sort of the run-of-the-mill guardianships that we see, but we have been seeing a lot more relating to elder law, elder exploitation.
How about you, Scott? What types of situations do you see where people become guardians?
Well, it's frequently a transitional situation, and I represent a lot of area agencies that provide services to people with disabilities and so forth, and mental health centers. And what I see is all of a sudden an individual turns 18, and the parents aren't aware that they need to get a guardianship in order to address often complicated medical issues. And so there's a lot of hurry up in those situations.
So this is a young adult who may have severe disabilities. All of a sudden they turn 18. Under the law, they're allowed to make their own decisions, but they can't. So the parents actually need guardianship of their own child.
That's right.
Wow.
And often offended by the fact that they have to have some sort of court blessing in order to do what they've been doing for the last 18 years.
So those are some of the situations that you see. How often do you see, Scott, the typical situation where there's, two or three adult children and mom turns 90 and just doesn't seem capable of managing anymore. And so the kids come to you and they say, we think one of us needs to be a guardian.
Usually what happens is one comes to me to say, my brother wants to be the guardian, but he's been helping himself to mom's resources, and I want to file for guardianship to keep him from being the guardian.
Oh, yikes.
That's the kind of dynamic.
So you're working through some family stuff there.
There's a lot of family stuff. And typically, if you get into a broad family squabble, it just doesn't seem to go away. Courts are generally inclined to appoint a public guardian, either the Office of Public Guardian or Tri-County CAP Guardianship Services.
Well, and we'll talk about that in a minute, because from what I understand, a fourth or a fifth of the adults under guardianship in New Hampshire have public guardians. But I am curious, Suzanne, as I said in the intro, you serve yourself as an adult guardian. Without divulging too much personal information about this person, how did you come to that place?
There was a family dispute about who should be the guardian, and the court actually called me and asked me if I would be interested in becoming the guardian. I was asked to come to court when they had the guardianship hearing. Really no dispute that the person needed a guardian. It was just a dispute over who should be the guardian. In that case, I believe that neither of the petitioners, they had filed competing guardianship petitions, met bonding requirements, which is a huge stumbling block for a lot of our guardians lately.
What does that mean? Don't meet bonding requirements.
So if you're managing assets for someone, the probate court requires you be bonded. And the bond is an insurance policy so that if the guardian steals all of the ward's assets, the money gets paid back into the guardianship estate. Sort of simply explain it. You have to be bonded. A requirement of that bond, they check your credit history. They check to see if there are bankruptcies. They check to see if there's felony convictions. And neither of the people that were petitioning could get bonded. So the court brought me in, went through the guardianship hearing. As I said, no issue about whether the guardianship needed to be granted or not, just an issue of who it was going to be. Neither of them could meet the standards, so the court ended up appointing me.
So the standard is there to protect the person, whether the elder or the person with severe disabilities, to protect them from being defrauded of their money or stolen from.
Exactly.
How did you come to your own situation, Scott, as a guardian?
Well, I got contacted by the court. There was a woman who had a mental illness. Her husband was a Christian Scientist. She needed to be medicated, to treat her severe mental illness. He refused to do so. And so there was a hearing, and I was appointed as the independent guardian. I think it's 15 years now. I'm still the guardian. I visit with her. I participate in treatment team meetings. I get midnight calls if there's medical concerns. Quite a bit of activity. Plus, I have to help with the Medicaid applications and also filing of annual reports.
That's a big responsibility, Scott.
It is. I'm lucky to have been employed by the Office of Public Guardian for a couple years, and so I got a pretty good idea of how their structure works, and that's been very helpful.
The exchange number for you to join us with your questions or comments about adult guardianship is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. If you have questions about how this works or personal experiences, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter to NHPR Exchange. And Doug McNutt, I want to bring you into this too with AARP. How do you see people becoming guardians? What are the typical stories that you hear about?
Well, for guardians, what we see are people who are caregivers who have, and unfortunately, don't have the option of planning in advance. So long-term care issues tend to be emergencies. You know, we talk a lot about long-term care, but really what happens is you have an adult son or daughter. Oftentimes, when we have a state like New Hampshire where people live out of state, they may be parachuting in from California, and they don't realize that mom or dad has deteriorated to the point where they might need a guardianship, and it's too late to do planning to avoid that. So there's that kind of situation. The other thing that's happening, sadly, in New Hampshire is we have this opioid crisis where, you know, there are grandparents who are getting into the guardianship mode as well. And so that's another factor that's happening.
Give us a little bit more on the opioid crisis. And again, talking about adult guardianship. So grandparents are getting guardianship of their 19-year-old grandkids?
Well, actually, more so their children's children.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happened is in New Hampshire, sadly, we're the second highest state in the country in terms of overdoses per 100,000 in the country. And we talk a lot about it, but that really is a stunning factor.
So guardianship in those first cases you talked about, Doug, seems to happen quickly sometimes.
Well, guardianship is not something that happens overnight. You can file for expedited guardianships, and I don't know that Suzanne and Scott know the timing better, but it's not something that is can happen immediately. It does take some time. And that's why, you know, as I say, it's important if you can to try to avoid those situations if at all possible.
Do you talk to some of these younger or middle-aged adults who all of a sudden find out that they may need to get guardianship of their parents? I'm just wondering what their sort of stories are.
Well, I mean, our focus is on legislative issues primarily, so I'm not a practitioner like Suzanne and Scott. So, I mean, I'll give you an example of a woman that is one of my volunteers. Her husband was perfectly healthy and one day fell off of an embankment and injured himself and was severely injured. She had to go get a guardianship in order to be able to take care of their business and financial issues.
So hang on, kind of the same reaction that the parents had in the example Scott gave. So a wife had to get guardianship of her husband?
That's,
I mean,
right.
Couldn't she just say, look, I'm the wife, you know, I've got the marriage certificate right here?
She couldn't even deal with Comcast. Comcast bill was in his name. You know, I mean, we're talking some really basic issues here.
So should husbands and wives listening right now get guardianship of each other?
What they should probably do is get a power of attorney and a financial power of attorney, which would obviate the need to do that down the road.
Wow. Okay. Scott, go ahead.
It's important to distinguish between guardianship for, say, the grandchild, the child of an addict who is being cared for by the grandparent, and guardianship for a person who has turned 18. Two completely different statutory frameworks. It's much simpler to get a guardian over a minor child than it is for an adult. And Doug is absolutely correct. The trick, as it were, for preventing the need for a guardianship is to have properly executed advance directives, healthcare power of attorney, financial power of attorney, living will, and so forth. Those under most circumstances, I would say almost all circumstances, if they're properly drafted, will eliminate the need to rush to get a guardianship.
You know, Scott, we've done many, many shows over the years on those other types of paperwork that you talk about, you know, power of attorney, durable power of attorney, healthcare proxy, and on and on and on. How widespread do you think these are being used these days, given that there's been, you know, several decades of effort to get people to do it?
Based on the fact that I do a lot of guardianships in situations where they could have had a power of attorney but neglected to, forgot to, or have an invalid power of attorney, I would say it's maybe 25% of the time.
That they actually have those papers.
That they are prepared.
What do you see, Suzanne?
I would agree with Scott. And even sometimes when you have the powers of attorney, if there is some sort of conflict, you may still see a guardianship petition. We had a guardianship we filed recently where the bank felt that the person named in the power of attorney was committing elder abuse, financial exploitation. They refused to acknowledge the power of attorney, and we ended up having to file for guardianship.
Wow. All right. Well, let's hear from our listeners. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Sorry, Doug, you wanted to jump in real quick there.
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about the power of attorney and the banks. We just did a Uniform Power of Attorney Act this year in the legislature, and one of the reasons was that there was a lot of difficulty in banks accepting powers of attorney. So we've tried to introduce some legislation that will hopefully deal with some of those issues, not necessarily abuse issues, but issues where banks weren't accepting powers of attorney. And also the hope, in addition, is that there'll be a statutory form, and for people who can't seek out an attorney, they'll be able to do it. How much it will help, we don't know, but we think it'll have some value. And Scott was involved with that a little bit as well.
Let's hear from our listeners. And from Durham, Peyton is calling in. Hi, Peyton. Go ahead. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, hi. Hey, I just want to say you're a tremendous resource for the state, and I love your show.
Thank you.
Every morning, it's great. So in my case, my mom was 75, and she was creating a life estate. And then I was assigned the healthcare proxy, and I was also given power of attorney if I would ever need it. We didn't really know what that meant, but then fast forward a few years later, my mom was actually at her bank trying to transfer funds, a wire transfer of about $20,000 somewhere else. And the bank manager called just because she knew me and said, your mom's down here trying to transfer funds. And so we looked at that, and she was actually in the middle of a scam where someone had was pretending to be a lottery official, and they said, if you prepay the tax, we'll deliver the funds to you. So it was a big mess. And then we started to realize that she was being attacked by her phone and via mail all the time.
Wow.
So we had to change her phone number and make it unlisted. We also had to introduce a P.O. box to prevent mail from being delivered unless we could filter it. But the ability to have power of attorney and, in a lot of cases, healthcare proxy has really helped with that. I'm not a guardian. I haven't gone to guardianship, but I have been, been considering that. But I will say that the power of attorney and the healthcare proxy, having those in place were very helpful when I had to do things, whether it's
right.
A brokerage account or whether it's the bank or whatever.
And hurrah for the bank, Peyton, right? For tipping you off. Yeah.
Lucky she lives in a small town and they were able to contact us. Otherwise, and we've heard other stories where people will transfer $50,000 or whatever. And you can never get that money back. So
Peyton, if I could ask you a quick question, please. Because your call's super interesting. So you had those sort of, pardon the expression, lower levels of paper. You didn't have full guardianship. So are you considering going that route with your mom, or do you feel you need to, or what?
At some point we might. She's sort of at mid-stage of Alzheimer's right now. And so we watch her account. We only have as much money in her checking account to pay monthly bills, and we've segmented all the other funds in case she is scammed. And so we're sort of looking forward to sort of the next layer of things that might take place. And so we're considering that, but right now, sort of staying with the power of attorney. That's been helpful in a lot of cases.
Okay. Well, thank you for calling in, Peyton. Very interesting. And Scott, go ahead.
One good thing that's occurred over the last few years is that they've passed a statute that makes it a criminal offense to engage in that kind of conduct. Prior to that, if you contacted the local law enforcement, they would say it's a civil matter. They're not involved. And if you want to seek redress, you have to do it in the civil court. I had an experience of a woman who had her money stolen, and we reported it, and the daughter, who happened to be the perpetrator, got indicted and is in jail.
Wow. Okay. We'll take a lot more of your calls, questions, and comments after a short break. The exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. More on adult guardianship in the Granite State after a short break. Stay with us.
This week on the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop, author Michael Cunningham has advice we can all take to heart, no matter what you do.
You have to figure out when it's time to just let it go, when this is all you can do. Over the years, I have developed a slightly better sense of when I've reached that point, when in rewriting, I'm not making it better, but I'm just making it different.
Subscribe to the podcast for sage advice or find some at nhpr.org/10mww.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, adult guardianship and how it can get complicated. About 6,000 Granite Staters over the age of 18 have legal guardians. And as the population ages, that number will likely go up. Let's get you into our conversation. Your comments, stories, questions are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Scott, Doug, and Suzanne, I want to just ask you a little bit more about that very interesting call we got from Peyton before the break. And Suzanne, to you too, you know, Peyton made two important points. One was that he had these sort of other pieces of paperwork, not full guardianship of his mom. So that helped him catch financial fraud. But also the local bank gave him a call and said, you know, your mom is about to do this.
Right. And that's been my experience, too, is that the local banks will either call if they know, you know, you're so-and-so's attorney because you've had prior involvement with them, or they will call Bureau of Elderly and Adult Services if they suspect some sort of fraudulent activity is going on. They're seeing somebody come in and ask for multiple wires to different locations, usually overseas. They will actually report it, and then BEAS will do an investigation.
That's Bureau of Elderly and Adult Services.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I'd love your thoughts too, Doug, on this, because it seems like in some situations, a guardian can really help the person from being abused. We talked earlier, though, about other situations where the guardian, him or herself, may not be too trustworthy. So it kind of runs both ways.
Yeah, and that's where the Bureau of Elderly and Adult Services Adult Protection Program comes in. They're there to provide investigations into inappropriate activities and people who are suffering from financial or other kinds of abuse. So that I worked a number of years ago at the Bureau of Elderly and Adult Services, and actually that's another area that occasional petitions for guardianship are filed as well. And those are cases where there isn't somebody, a family member involved particularly, or maybe a family member is abusing the person, but there's no one to file for guardianship, and that's in limited cases the state will step in. So that's another category that we haven't talked about as well.
Let's take another call, and this is Bill calling in from Guilford. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Laura. I appreciate this. This is a great discussion. I appreciate you bringing it to the forefront.
Good.
A question for you guys, and that is, we recently relocated to New Hampshire permanently, and we have a durable power of attorney, financial durable power of attorney, in another state. With the legislative changes, is it necessary to format it particularly for the state of New Hampshire? Because we want to make sure that we're up to date. This is between my wife and myself.
So this is durable power of attorney for who, Bill?
Durable power of attorney between my wife and I.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right. So you're wondering, since you moved to New Hampshire, do you have to change all that? Suzanne, do you know?
I generally recommend that when people move in from different states that they come in and see a local attorney to have their documents updated. The New Hampshire Advance Directive, which contains the health care power of attorney and the living will, unfortunately, none of the states have made that a uniform document. So the health care powers of attorney are different in each state. And we generally recommend that those be updated, just because the medical community tends to accept the document that's from their own state. They know how it's interpreted, and they're much less nervous about accepting a New Hampshire advance directive than they might be an out-of-state healthcare document. And I would say that the local banks and are more likely to want to deal with the local format. I mean, we have a statutory format for the financial power of attorney as well, in terms of what it says if you become incapacitated and things like that. So I think in general, it's a good idea if you come in from out of state to have those documents updated.
Okay, well, there's your answer, Bill. Thank you for the call. And to Bristol, where Bruce is on the air. Hi, Bruce. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning, Laura. You're the best. I won't take a lot of time. I just wanted to tell you, I was appointed guardian in another state. I practice law, and I had a nice lady come in, and her sister was a rapid cycler bipolar sufferer. And she did things like drive her car down the street with the hood up and with the windows down because she thought the CIA was after her. This went on and on for months. And finally, she came in tears and said, what are we going to do? And I said, well, we could pursue guardianship, but she's bipolar. And when she's medicated, she's as good as you and me. Well, we took it to the court and made the argument that she had so many of these rapid cycles on the aggressive side that she was incapacitated and could be adjudicated incompetent. Well, then the next step was, who was going to be the guardian? And I had thought the sister was going to do it. And at some point after the guardianship was set up preliminarily, we had to go back in and appoint. She said, I can't do it. And she looked at me and said, well, will you do it?
Yeah, it's a big responsibility. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, it turns out this my ward, ultimately, was my vice principal from junior high school, which made it more interesting.
Oh, my goodness. Well. Yeah.
So, anywho, long story made short, we went back in. She was appointed an attorney. The judge asked us questions. The family was there, her sister, basically. And the judge asked me, you want to do it? And I said, yes. And that started 17 years of the most enriching thing I ever did as a lawyer.
Wow. So you are the guardian for an adult in another state, Bruce.
Mm-hmm. And she's since passed away.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But the interesting thing about it was perfect. We had her set up with Meals on Wheels. I mean, I basically had to get her a safety net every day to make sure people were checking in on her. And we talked every morning over breakfast and a phone call and so forth and so on. But the funniest thing was at some point when she was out and about doing her thing, she kind of had to explain who I was. So she got it in her head that like, you remember the lawyer named Jaggers from Great Expectations, the novel? Well, she literally had her friends convinced that I was her personal lawyer and that she was really wealthy, but nobody really knew that. But she called me for advice on just about everything. So, she's saying, well, should we go to the store this morning? Well, I don't know. Let me call my lawyer.
Yeah. Well, what a story. And I'm so glad you called because, you know, it is easy, Doug, to look at this and you do hear terrible stories of, you know, adult children abusing their parents or just stories of people being assigned private guardians who take advantage of them. But then you've got people, you know, like our caller who just are doing it because nobody else will and saying that, you know, by the way, on the other end, it's an enriching experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And Scott and Suzanne have talked about that. And one of the things, when he mentions out of state, I thought I might mention that we passed a law a couple of years ago called the Uniform Adult Guardianship Protective Proceeding and Jurisdiction Act. It's a mouthful.
Yeah.
Well done.
One of the things that it prevents is a so-called granny snatching. And, you know, there used to be these instances where somebody would take their grandparent to another state and pursue guardianship. And
granny snatching.
Granny snatching, right. And so this is proposed to prevent that. And it's kind of in some ways like a child custody jurisdiction kind of concept where the guardianship, the courts will look at where the person really is, not necessarily their home, but where is their sort of lexus, where should they be and where should the guardianship be? And so it sort of helps to prevent that kind of situation. It would also help prevent the kind of situation where a person, there is a guardianship and they move to another state, and it would smooth the way for the guardianship to be accepted in that other state. So just kind of a...
That's the first time I've heard that term, granny
sounds
snatching.
Sounds like a sneeze.
Yeah, wow. And serious, though, because you do read stories like that. Go ahead, Scott.
I've had two instances of granny snatching. One prior to the act that Doug just was able to articulate, and one afterward.
And when was that, by the way?
The first one was passed 2 years ago.
Oh, so pretty recent.
The first one, it took 9 months and hearings and appointment of guardians in Florida to get, and she was my ward at that point, no longer with us, to get enough jurisdiction in Florida to get her back to New Hampshire. The second one, which
where
was
she wanted to be.
Where she wanted to be and had been absconded. The second one was within the last 4 months or so, involved Pennsylvania, and it took almost no time at all, probably a week. in order for there to be recognition of the out-of-state guardianship. And they then participated in retrieving the individual and bringing back.
Suzanne, how often do you run into difficulty across state lines? Now, our last caller said, you know, it worked out fine, but I just wonder about that.
I actually have not had a lot of experience with that. I've had many people come in and they're thinking about moving, but in the end they don't. So I would probably defer that question to Scott.
We find a lot of folks who retire to Florida, particularly. They have an adult disabled child. They decide not to live in Florida anymore, and they come back to New Hampshire, to where perhaps they grew up. And at that particular point, the guardianship will work, but as Suzanne referred to previously, we encourage them to comply with New Hampshire law and address that issue so that there's no ambiguity.
Let's take another call, and this is Steve in Nottingham. Welcome, Steve. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, good morning, and again, thank you for this topic. I'm a psychiatrist, and I want to go a step earlier. Wow. The decision for guardianship has to be based on a medical, and from my point of view, psychiatric condition. Often it's Alzheimer's, but you need a very strong medical and psychiatric evaluation will include something like a mental status. Does the person know who they are, the time of day, what their recent memory? This type of information is critical for the subset. This is the information the courts need to make the next decision. And that, I'm just arguing for that type of first step before we get to the legal step.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for the point. And it does raise the point, and I'll throw it out there to everybody, maybe you first, Scott. But how is it decided by the court that, you know, yes, Scott needs a guardian, or no, he does not? Our caller, Steve, is right. You know, it's a big decision and one that should take into a lot of factors.
There are days I need a guardian. Guardianship, first of all, the standard of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the same standard of proof for essentially convicting someone of murder. The second thing,
it's a high bar.
It's a very high bar. The second thing is that the criteria for determining guardianship is not a medical model. It is based upon functional incapacity. Can the person balance a checkbook? Can they cook? Do they tend to leave the pot of soup on the stove, forget about it, and, you know, essentially cause a fire? You know, all of the basic functions, including what are referred to as ADLs, which are essentially personal care, medical decision making. Typically they have meds, but they, even with a little, one of these little plastic things, they still don't remember to take the meds. So it's those kinds of practicalities that really determine it. The psychiatrist that just spoke, I think he is correct that having an assessment as to, especially in dementia, in terms of who's the president, you know, what's the date, you know, what is your name, you know, where do you live, and those kinds of basic questions, plus any organic issues in the brain, they're helpful, but they're only ancillary to the functional aspects.
So it's a pretty high bar based on what you can do for yourself. Is it high enough, Doug?
Oh, it's,
or is it too high?
Well, I mean, I think there's arguments about whether it's too high. But, I mean, if you look at this town, we used to have a state hospital that had 1,200 people there. And some of those people were people who had been guardianships had been imposed by their spouses even. Imagine that back in the old days in the 60s. We now have about 200 people there. And that's not just because of the guardianship issue. There's many other issues, but I think that's part of it. I think Scott's quite right. I mean, the best example I can give about functionality is you could be diagnosed today with dementia. It would not make you incompetent or unable to take care of your affairs. Later on, your dementia may get to the point where you're unable to take care of yourself. But day one, assuming it's not very far down the road, it really doesn't have anything to do with whether or not you need a guardian.
Do you want to jump in, Suzanne?
Yeah, I mean, the practical aspect of this is when you file a petition for guardianship, you have to allege incidents that have occurred within so many days of filing the petition that show that the person cannot perform activities of daily living or that they have, you know, been wiring money to Nigeria or things like that. Those have to be alleged in the petition. The court will assign an attorney to the ward, or if the ward is already represented by counsel, will ask that attorney to step in and represent the ward. They, and Scott and I have both done this, when I've been the petitioner for someone, when I've filed the petition, he's been the attorney for the ward and vice versa. You go and visit with the person, and, you know, the thing is, for about, I always have kind of the 10-minute standard. The 10-minute standard is that they are very conversant. They may seem like they're oriented. They may seem like they understand what's going on. And it's usually at about that 10-minute break that things start to get interesting. So they may know who the president is. They may know what day it is. They may know, you know, who's helping them, you know, make out checks. I mean, quite often you see the kids will make out the checks and they'll just sign them and things like that. But then, you know, I'm thinking of this gentleman that we recently filed for guardianship over who was involved in a scam. And when I started asking him about that, that's when I really began to get an idea of his limitations in terms of understanding things, because he didn't want to believe me, first of all. Second of all, he was absolutely convinced that this was, you know, real and legal and everything else. And, you know, it was just, if we just sent him one more payment, you know, it was all going to be, everything was going to be wonderful. So you do spend some time with them. If it's a contested guardianship where you either have people who are challenging each other for guardianship or the ward is challenging the guardianship, because sometimes you'll go and see these people. You may have an opinion, if you're the attorney for the ward, that they are not competent and need a guardian, but you're appointed to represent them. And if they want to fight the guardianship, that's what you have to do. So a lot of times they will come to court and want to take the stand and want to testify, you know, as to why they don't need this guardianship. So there's plenty of opportunity for the ward to be heard. The court can see the person themselves. The court can ask questions themselves of the proposed ward. So there's a lot of protections built in for the ward in that, and the guardianship proceedings.
I want to read just a little bit from a Wall Street Journal article about guardianship and sometimes the abuses of people trying to get money out of elderly people. This has to do with a woman in Vancouver, Washington. It turned out Ms. McDowell's former housemate and companion had pushed for a court petition claiming Ms. McDowell was unable to take care of herself. The petition said Ms. McDowell had recently made an unsafe driving maneuver, had been disruptive in a doctor's office, and in a recent phone call had seemed confused over the whereabouts of some personal papers. Based on this, the judge ordered an attorney to act as a temporary guardian with control over Ms. McDowell's money and medical care. And then Ms. McDowell was shocked. And over the course of, you know, a year or two, she basically was drained out of $700,000 in assets. Now, this is one case, but boy, I mean, looking at the standard, I mean, an unsafe driving maneuver. Who here hasn't done that? I mean, you know, confused over whereabouts is in personal papers. Guilty as charged. Now, I have myself not become disruptive in a doctor's office, but, you know, we've all dealt with the medical bureaucracy and sometimes we feel like it. So I'm just struck by this, Doug, that, you know, there are cases where it seems like guardianship is handed over too easily.
I don't think that's typical in New Hampshire. In fact, in New Hampshire, and I know in the past I've been appointed to be a sort of a guardian ad litem to do a research about the individual and make a report to the court. So I'm sure Scott and Suzanne have examples as well, but I don't think that would be likely in New Hampshire. But
all right, maybe after break we can talk a little bit more about guardian ad litem. Lots of emails and calls too, so keep it right here. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, adult guardianship. About 6,000 Granite Staters over the age of 18 have legal guardians. We're finding out how these situations arise, what makes them work, and what doesn't. Give us a call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like, NHPR Exchange. And all of you, before we go back to our listeners, you know, we've talked a lot about adults becoming guardians for their elderly parents or an elderly aunt or uncle. Maybe to you first, Scott, what about younger adults who become guardians for siblings, for example, who may have disabilities or other issues that prevent them from meeting their own needs? What does guardianship mean for these people?
Well, it's extremely difficult to be a guardian. You're essentially being a parent in the sense of, you know, you've got to take care of all the details, the medical, the medication, all of the documents for Medicaid, Medicare, whatever it may be. In my experience, most younger people, say there's a 30-year-old ward and a 25-year-old sibling, I generally find that they defer to someone else.
Because it's just too much to handle.
It's too much to handle. And a lot of times they're not bondable. And as we talked about, you have to have a surety bond in order to manage finances.
To prove that you have reasonable resources and that you're not going to leave the state in the lurch. Interesting. Have you dealt with any of these situations, Suzanne, of sort of younger people who suddenly find themselves having to care for a sibling?
I can't say that I can think of any in my last 25 years of practice, actually.
Right.
I do know I do have some adult guardians of a disabled child who is over the age of 18 now, and they are very concerned about what happens when they pass in terms of there being a gap in the guardianship. Because even though they have lined up as much as they can to make sure that a sibling is going to be ready to step in, you still have to go through the court and get that process approved. So they're concerned about the gap in time, and obviously we would want to file it on an expedited basis. As Doug alluded to earlier, though, that expedited basis sometimes doesn't happen. Expedited basis, when you file a petition, means that you are supposed to be in front of the court within 2 weeks. I did file one recently. We're going to be in front of the court within 10 days, which is great. But in Belknap County, our judge only sits 2 days a month. And if she's on vacation and one of her days to sit is a Monday, you know, Memorial Day, Labor Day, Columbus Day, those are all Monday holidays. So we quite frequently will have some gaps in time where we cannot get an expedited hearing.
Well, I was wondering about that because going through the materials, it does seem like the courts are heavily involved at every step of the way. And you're right. I mean, the courts are, we're often told, are overwhelmed and there's not enough, you know, judges and staff to see all kinds of cases, never mind guardianship. So I did wonder about how much you're slowed down by that.
Yeah, it's as I said, with the expedited, you're supposed to be able to get in front of the court within 2 weeks. We just did file for one last week where we have a hearing coming up this Monday. So that was good. But I have had them denied in other situations, and they're just ordered as the court's docket allows, quote unquote.
Wow.
And it may take some time to get in front of the court.
Well, if you're in a crisis situation over a guardianship, 2 weeks does not feel expedited.
No, it does not.
Go ahead, Scott.
My experience is that over the last 5 years, expedited guardianships have been denied as a matter of course, unless there is really something compelling.
Now, why is that?
Judicial time, lack of resources. The other thing to mention is there is also a temporary guardianship, which is good for 60 days. Same proof, same documents. But that is a vehicle where you can get in the door, so to speak, and get action in an emergency very quickly.
Let's take another call. And this is Diane in Nashua. Hi, Diane. Thanks for calling on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
You just kind of touched base on what I wanted to ask. I'm the parent of a 24-year-old special needs child. And my question is, what can I do beforehand to make sure that I have a particular person that I want to be his guardian? But my worry is, if something happens to me, what can I do to make it, to expedite it so that it kind of goes as, you know, smoothly as possible and there's not like a 2 week gap or any, you know, anything? Is there anything I can do beforehand to make it easier when the time comes for my brother to have to step in or whoever is going to end up taking him.
Wow. Diane, thank you for the call. So I'm going to turn to you maybe, Suzanne, on that one. You know, you can't give legal advice on the air. I want to be respectful of that. But I wonder about these situations where, just in case something happens to Diane, she wants to make sure that her child is taken care of.
Right. So I think she said it was her brother that she wants to take over as guardian. I mean, the best thing that he can do is make sure that he's in touch with an attorney or whoever's going to file a petition for him so that he can get that filed as soon as possible after something happens. And we also will put in our clients' wills. If they're serving as guardian for someone, we will put in the wills a provision, much like you see with minor children, saying, you know, if something happens to me, I'm currently the legal guardian for my child, and I would like my brother. The one thing that you have to realize, though, in wills is that it's really an expression of preference. The court will decide what is in the best interest of the ward, and if they don't believe the brother is the best candidate, they may award it to someone else. And the same is true with minor guardianships, too. You have to understand it's a strong indication of who you believe is qualified and who you would like to see be the guardian, but it isn't always going to carry the day.
Go ahead, Scott.
A lot of times what occurs is you'll have the 65 to 70-year-old parent with a 50-year-old disabled person, and they're concerned about continuity.
Sure.
What we frequently will do is petition the court to appoint a co-guardian being someone, perhaps a younger sibling or something like that, to be the guardian. So they're actually literally in place, and there's no disruption, as our caller indicated.
Okay, well, Diane, there you go. Thank you for calling in. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. A couple emails I want to share with all of you. This is from Joan, who says, I think it's important for you to know that at the probate court, they do not always take all of the information into consideration. A different judge may see someone on the same case, but that information is not used in the next interaction or hearing. Simple information like filing an appearance is not explained to a system novice, so important information is lost. The big picture is lost, lies not exposed. Joan says, my twin sister in her 50s, too, has been in and out of jail on the state hospital, but is allowed to continue interacting with family members that tell her to stop taking the medication, sabotages her treatment. It is heartbreaking, frustrating, impossible to deal with. The state of mental health treatment in New Hampshire is appalling. Joan, I'm so sorry to hear about your situation. And I wonder, all of you, you know, how often these situations with mental health care and the gaps that we hear about there interact with this issue of guardianship. Scott, do you want to jump on that?
I think that that is very, very common. And it takes different sort of avenues. Sometimes individuals are retaining somebody who should not be living in a home, for example, primarily because they want to maintain benefits. There are other situations where there's a real dispute about whether mom really needs a guardian or where she should be in a nursing home. And one of the biggest issues is mom should be at home. And that has been tried, and it's been a failure, and it's dangerous. And so recommendation is for a secure, you know, nursing home with a dementia unit. And there, I've got dozens of cases where there's disputes over that.
How often, Doug, is a healthcare institution like a nursing home or an assisted living facility designated a guardian? Can an institution be a guardian?
No. That would be inappropriate because that institution is responsible for the care and they're accepting payments. I mean, they're just too much. That's fraught with peril. And I think I'm not sure about the law, but I'm pretty sure that's not possible.
And I would also note, as just sort of a historical example, when the folks were at the state school back in the 70s and 80s, almost none of them had guardians. And the reason that the Office of Public Guardian is in existence now is because when they deinstitutionalized the state school, they had to appoint guardians to address those kinds of issues and represent those residents.
Go ahead, Doug.
Federal law is really, at this point, really almost requires nursing homes to make sure that if a person doesn't have a power of attorney, that there be a guardianship. And there's been a lot of that's happened within the last 15 years or so. And that's precisely to prevent the kind of abuse that could take place with an institution.
Okay. So most people in a nursing home have some sort of a guardian
outside
the institution.
My experience is the institution will as part of the admission process, we'll force that issue.
You know, we got an email earlier from someone who said, thank you for the show. It's very timely given the aging of New Hampshire's population. I wonder what you think, Doug. Are we going to see more issues around guardianship, more people taking on guardianship or not?
Well, you know, for those of you who know, Steve Norton is with the Center for Public Policy here in New Hampshire. I mean, we know from a demographic standpoint that the population is aging, and it's not so much 65 plus. It's when you get to 80 and 85 plus. And we know that in the probably 10 or so years, we're going to have a doubling of that population. So we know in terms of things like dementia and Alzheimer's, the incidence certainly grows the older you get. So those factors together really tell you that there probably will be other issues. And that's why I think it's really important now when you're younger to think about the planning procedures, because we've talked about how difficult the guardianship process is, and if you can all avoid it, this is the time to be thinking about it.
Wow. Well, here's a question toward that end from Jackie in Wilton, and I'll throw this to you, Suzanne. What is the difference between power of attorney and guardianship? Jackie says, my mother is 89. I have been her power of attorney for 10 years, paying her bills, working with her medical team. She is in Pennsylvania, and I am in New Hampshire. She now lives in a skilled nursing facility. And Jackie, thank you for the email. I was wondering about that, too. What is really the difference?
So the power of attorney, when I have clients come in and they want to do wills or trusts or whatever, we do the financial power of attorney, also known as the durable power of attorney, and the New Hampshire Advanced Directive, which is the healthcare power of attorney and living will. Strongly recommend those documents. Those are lifetime documents if you become incapacitated, so someone can make medical decisions for you and someone can handle your finances. Generally, if all goes well, you won't ever need to file for guardianship over someone who has those documents. Those documents should take care of all the issues that will arise until the person passes and then the will or the trust takes over. A lot of people don't understand that the powers of attorney end at death. You'll have people say, well, my mother passed away and I went into the bank to get her account and they're not recognizing my power of attorney anymore. That's because it ends when the person dies. But the power of attorney, if it's well written, if there are backup agents named, which I strongly recommend, you know, we'll have clients come in and say, well, I don't really trust anybody to be my power of attorney other than my spouse, so I don't want to put a backup on. Well, if you've appointed dad as your power of attorney and dad passes away and there's no backup named, then you're going to have to go for a guardianship. So the guardianships are needed when you don't have those documents, if there's family disputes over those documents, if there's allegations against the agent in the power of attorney that they've been financially exploiting mom or dad. That's when you're usually forced into the probate court to get a guardianship. So if you have the power of attorney, generally it's a good substitute that won't ever have to go the guardianship route. But if there are issues down the road, you may well end up going the guardianship route, even if those documents exist. One of the questions on the guardianship petition is whether those documents exist. And if they do, the court wants to know, well, what's the issue? If the power of attorney is in place, why are you petitioning for guardianship?
Is guardianship expensive?
I would say it's expensive in the sense that generally if finances are involved, the bonding companies are requiring that you be represented by counsel. They have been burned far too many times by individual guardians not represented by counsel, not doing what they're supposed to be doing.
In other words, taking advantage of the
right. So the bonding companies are generally requiring, our bonding company requires a letter to be submitted saying that they will be represented by our firm through the guardianship and that they will not discharge us, or if they do discharge us, they will retain another law firm to represent them.
So there are legal fees involved.
There's legal fees involved. There's the cost of the bond, which is, as I said before, the insurance policy in case you run off with the money. There's the filing fees with the court. Once you're appointed as guardian, you have to file annual reports with the court of both how the money is being spent, and if you're the guardian over the person, you have to also file a report about where the person is, what the care is, what's going on with the person medically, and what their placement is, if there's any programs going on, and information like that.
So time-consuming and expensive, Scott. It kind of makes me wonder if it's guardians, good-hearted guardians, are being discouraged.
Well, to some degree, it's a lot of work, a lot of responsibility. It is a fiduciary position. With respect to the question by the last caller, the difference between a power of attorney and a guardianship is that under many, many circumstances, the power of attorney can be revoked by the individual, even if they're quite demented. A guardianship is indelible. The only time it can be changed is through a court proceeding process where there's a request to either modify or terminate the guardianship. So that's
a big difference.
That's a big difference.
What do you think about that question, Doug? Given the time involved, Suzanne described all the paperwork, the money involved. I've read that guardianship is emotionally taxing. What do you think? People listening might go, forget it.
Well, it is difficult, and I think it's hard to do it without being represented by an attorney. I mean, I remember I did a guardianship. It's been many years, but I remember this distinguished businessman was on the stand testifying about his mother-in-law, and he broke into tears, and I wasn't expecting it. But you have to realize that this is an incredibly emotionally taxing process. It's also complicated for a layperson to walk into that court and figure out how to do a petition, how to put together a case. So you pretty much have to be represented by counsel, I would say, unless you're somebody who's kind of extraordinarily able to figure out things on your own. So it's hard.
Well, and I appreciate that you raised the emotional aspect, too. I mean, in addition to all the confusion over legal stuff and, you know, fear over financial stuff, there's the whole emotional sort of, wow, I'm supposed to be the guardian for this adult that I've always looked up to.
Well, you're also testifying about how your mother-in-law, you know, is taking her cat's medication and things like that. It's, you know, it's kind of depressing.
Yeah. Well, this has been very helpful. Thank you all very much for being here. I really appreciate it. Doug, it was good to see you.
Thank you.
Doug McNutt, he works on advocacy for AARP. Scott McGuffin, great to have you. Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Scott McGuffin, attorney at McGuffin Law, where he specializes in guardianship. And Suzanne Chisholm, thank you also. Really good to talk to you.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Suzanne Chisholm, founding attorney with Lawson, Pearson & Chisholm. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.